Today, we're critiquing a white paper that extends biological concepts of molecular autopoiesis and structural coupling into a framework for civilizational repair.
Right. It's a really ambitious piece of work.
It is, yeah. But the bridge connecting the biological concepts of molecular autopoiesis to macro-civilizational traps could be fortified to make the shift less jarring for the reader.
Yeah, that leap happens pretty fast, doesn't it?
Exactly. I mean, the material makes a really strong case for civilizational evolution by highlighting the eudaimon. That's the organism niche ecological dynamic unit.
Which is a great anchor.
Right, it is. And, you know, for those tracking the biology, autopoiesis, which is the way a cell literally recreates its own boundary from within to maintain its life, that's just a brilliant starting point.
Oh, definitely.
And then the author takes this and pairs it with Humberta Maturana's theories regarding early mother-child play. It lays down this really beautiful foundation where humanness itself is born not from, like, domination or abstraction, but from this intimate, relational space of touch, languaging, and play.
It's super compelling. But the acceleration you mentioned.
Yeah, the acceleration. As I was moving through the text, I noticed the sudden massive jump. We go directly from these cellular, interpersonal, biological realities straight to global systemic phenomena, like the Thucydides trap or the Midas trap.
Right, skipping right over the middle ground.
Completely. Honestly, it feels a bit like explaining the molecular structure of a clay brick in vivid, granular detail, and then immediately pivoting to critique the complex zoning laws of a massive metropolis. You're just kind of left holding the brick, wondering exactly how it scaled up to build the whole city.
Is the connection between A and B fully established in the material, or is that an area to potentially bolster? Because while the conceptual leap is ambitious and, you know, intellectually thrilling, relying strictly on the abstract concept of conserved drifts as the sole connective tissue between microbiology and global geopolitics really does leave a structural gap.
Right. It's just a bit too abstract.
Geoeconomic networks without losing the operational thread. The weakness here is just that civilizational traps operate on a scale of complexity that practically demands intermediate mechanisms.
Right. If we just say we go toward what we conserve, we miss the actual machinery of how that drift builds a global trap.
Exactly. Which is why introducing a meso-level institutional stepping stone is my main suggestion here. By inserting a transitionary scale between the individual organism and global civilization, the author can definitively prove that this biological framework scales logically.
So we need to see the brick build a single load-bearing wall before we look at the city grid.
That's a perfect way to put it, yeah.
Okay, so let's think of a concrete example for this. Instead of leaping straight from the mother-child play dynamic to the Midas trap, we could detail a specific mid-sized community or a single institution.
Let's use the misrelevance trap as our concrete example. The paper defines misrelevance as the drift of attention and metrics toward what does not serve life.
Okay, I like where this is going.
So to bridge the micro to the macro, we illustrate this trap by tracking how a single local hospital slowly drifted over a decade. You show the reader how it started with a life value metric system. Patient healing, relational care, legitimate coexistence, those were the operational priorities being conserved.
Right, but we can't just generalize. We have to show how a doctor's daily routine gets structurally coupled to that changing economic niche. So you detail how, year by year, the hospital's internal metrics shifted to a money value system, like billing efficiency and throughput.
And what happens to the biology of the organism in that new space? The doctors and nurses are forced into a new structural coupling. A doctor stops asking, what does this patient need to heal? And starts asking, what billing code justifies this 15-minute window?
Yeah, it's a shift in languaging driven by the environment. By grounding the jump from autopoiesis to abstract traps in a tangible human organization like a hospital, the reader can literally feel how a conserved drift operates.
Exactly. They see the precise moment a human interaction turns into an abstract extraction. And once they grasp that localized mechanism, applying it to global algorithmic trading becomes an effortless cognitive leap.
That makes a ton of sense. It really anchors the theory. And, you know, if we are grounding these abstract concepts in real-world institutions, we must also pressure test the paper's core ethical claim against real-world institutional friction.
Oh, definitely. The ethics have to hold up.
Right. So framing love as the ultimate orientation for civilizational reflection is profound, but the material somewhat glosses over how this concept survives in the face of entrenched, hostile power structures.
It's a tough environment out there for love.
It really is. As I understand it from the notes, the argument here is that love is defined as legitimate coexistence. It's the foundation of liberating conversation, and without love, distinction becomes negation.
Which is a beautifully articulated baseline.
It is, yeah. But I found myself pushing back intellectually. I mean, how does a life-coherent system actually set boundaries against a hostile aggressive force without accidentally adopting the very fear-based security, the Thucydides trap, that it aims to dismantle?
That's fascinating. What are the potential limitations or counterarguments to that idea? Because the weakness I see is that while the theoretical definition of love is robust, it lacks an operational defense against active negation.
Right. It doesn't explain how you survive when the other side isn't playing nice.
Exactly. The paper doesn't fully address how legitimate coexistence operates when the opposing party is actively conserving sacred insecurity or outright domination. Without a defense mechanism, it risks coming off as passive acceptance.
It's the classic dilemma of tolerance, you know? If you tolerate intolerance, the intolerant system destroys you.
So the suggestion here is to dedicate a brief subsection explicitly addressing the limits, boundaries, and practical applications of love within hostile domains.
Just to clarify how life coherence actually defends itself.
Right. Let's provide a concrete example explicitly distinguishing between the negation of the other and life-coherent boundary setting.
Okay, what if we looked at historical civil resistance movements?
Oh, that's perfect. The mechanics of a successful, nonviolent protest fit this flawlessly. Protesters do something very specific. They refuse to cooperate with the oppressive institution.
Yeah, they block the roads, they go on strike. They are setting a hard physical boundary without asking for permission.
Exactly. They interrupt the flow of living that the oppressor relies on. That is pure structural uncoupling. But, and this is the crucial distinction, they do so while simultaneously maintaining the humanity of their oppressors.
Right. They don't conserve revenge. They maintain legitimate coexistence with the police officer standing in front of them, even while dismantling the power structure.
Yes, it proves that love can be a rigorous defensive strategy rather than just passive acceptance. It's a highly operational tool for civilizational repair.
That adds so much necessary friction to the theory. It really proves it can take a punch. So, moving on, once the theoretical arguments are structurally grounded and pressure tested against real-world friction, the final step is examining how these arguments are stylistically delivered to the reader on the page.
The delivery is just as important as the message.
Exactly. And the frequent use of rapid-fire, repetitive list structures to demonstrate contrasting worldviews slightly blunts the analytical edge of the otherwise highly sophisticated prose.
The author is clearly going for a specific rhetorical rhythm, though.
Oh, absolutely. And it is poetic. But let's look closely at the section discussing the traps as conserved drifts. The author relies heavily on rhythmic phrasing. It's like, if we conserve fear, we go toward the Thucydides trap. If we conserve domination, we go toward violence. If we conserve money value, we go toward the Midas trap. If we conserve sacred insecurity.
Building on that point, what if we looked at it from the perspective of reader engagement? Because while this formatting is striking initially, the repetitive cadence becomes really predictable.
You start to zone out a bit.
Yeah, reader fatigue sets in. The weakness here is that it flattens incredibly distinct, complex civilizational traps into a uniform rhythm, risking having the reader just skim right over critical, nuanced mechanisms.
That's so true. The mechanical difference between the Midas trap and sacred insecurity is vast. They shouldn't be paced identically in a laundry list.
So my suggestion is to break up these repetitive lists by selecting only the most powerful contrasts. We replace the rhythmic repetition with deeper, more engaging analytical exposition.
Okay, give me a concrete example of how the author could do that.
Instead of listing six, if we conserve X, we go toward Y, statements in a row. Select the strongest two. For instance, focus strictly on how fear leads to the Thucydides trap and how a misrelevance leads to intelligent collapse.
Oh, I see. So you cut the other four items and take the space saved to unpack the specific step-by-step mechanism of how that drift actually occurs in a short paragraph.
Exactly. Keep the reader engaged with the why, rather than just scrolling past a list of what's.
Yeah, that forces the reader to actually visualize the trap snapping shut, instead of just swallowing a list of terms. It gives the ideas the breathing room they really demand.
It sharpens the impact immensely.
It really does. Well, let's briefly recap the three main areas of our critique today. First, we talked about bridging the micro-macro structural gap with a meso-level institutional example, like tracing the drift of a local hospital.
Crucial for scaling the theory.
Right. Second, we suggested bolstering the framework by demonstrating how love and legitimate coexistence operationally defend against hostile power structures, using civil resistance as a practical model.
Giving love some operational teeth.
Exactly. And third, we recommended replacing rhythmic, repetitive lists with deeper analytical exposition to maintain reader engagement and highlight those nuanced mechanisms.
All highly actionable steps.
Definitely. We'd love to invite the listener to apply these actionable suggestions and submit their revised white paper back in for future feedback. We always enjoy seeing how these pieces evolve. Thanks for joining us for this critique, and keep up the great work.